You're listening to After the Storm, where the healing begins on UK Health Radio. I'm Brian D. Smith, founder of Grief to Growth and a certified grief guide, life coach, and author. This part of my journey began after the passing of my 15-year-old daughter, Shayna. So I'm doing the work too. Each week, we explore the journey through grief, not just surviving loss, but discovering who you're becoming on the other side of it. This is where the healing begins. Hey there, welcome back to After the Storm. This is Brian Smith, your host. Before I get started with today's show, I want to say I'm really enjoying doing this for UK Health Radio. It's pushing me to go look at things a little bit different way. This is not my normal audience who might be a little bit more woo-woo, and I talk a lot about spiritual things, in addition to grief, of course. But what it's forced me to do is really to look at grief from a health point of view and from a connection to the body point of view. And it's really forcing me to learn some things. So I appreciate this opportunity. What I want to talk about today is the fact that your body knows things that your mind hasn't even admitted yet. There's a tightness that we get in our chest, for example, that arrives out of nowhere. There's the exhaustion that we have that sleep won't touch. It's the autoimmune flare that we have that started, if you actually count the months, a year and a half after the funeral. The thing is, grief doesn't just live in your heart, metaphorically speaking. It lives in your tissues. Now, last week, I sat with Ines Segal, and if you missed that episode, please go back and listen, because today actually builds directly on that. Ines describes something that most of us have felt, but we've really never had language for. And that's the idea that the body keeps a record. That pain can carry a message. That grief that doesn't get expressed, that grief that doesn't get processed, it doesn't evaporate. It goes somewhere. It goes into the body. Now, what Ina talked about was things like chronic back pain that no doctor could fix. And she was a young woman, a grief that she held in her body for years. And then the part that really stayed with me was the grief of her grandmother, a Holocaust survivor, showing up generations later in his own digestive system. Grief that wasn't even hers to begin with. Grief that happened to someone two generations earlier, showing up in Ina's body. And you may have heard that, and you may have felt it really land in your bones, but you may have thought, well, that's just an anecdote. That's just Ina's story. That's a story she's told herself. There's no evidence that this was her grandmother's grief showing up in her. There's no evidence that even her own grief was causing her problems. So you may be a more skeptical person. That's fine. I'm all about the skeptics. And you may have thought, well, that's a lovely idea, Brian, but where's the evidence? Well, I'm all about bringing you the evidence. I've told you from the very beginning, I will never ask you to believe anything without providing you at least reasons why I think it happens to be true. So today is for you. I'm going to take what Ina described from the inside, from her own personal experience, from lived experience, and we're going to lay it next to what the evidence says from the outside. The cardiology journals, the immune studies, the brain scans. And you'll find is that when science finally catches up to what grieving people have always known in their bodies, it doesn't say, oh, how quaint. The science says, the evidence says that Ina was right. You are not a mind riding around inside a body like a driver in a car. You are a mind-body, one thing. Ellen Langer, the Harvard psychologist, spent a career proving that in a laboratory. It's not just the mind-body connection. It's that we are this one thing, the mind-body, mind-body. Ellen studied what would happen with people if they just thought about things differently. And one of the experiments she did was to take housekeepers or chambermaids and tell them that their daily work, things like changing bed sheets and dusting and cleaning toilets, etc., that daily work already counted as serious exercise. She changed nothing about what they did. They did the same beds, the same hours against a control group where she didn't tell them this, so they were doing the same task. Weeks later, the group that she told their work was serious exercise showed drops in weight, in body fat, and in blood pressure. Now, keep in mind, they were doing the exact same task. Nothing changed about what they were physically doing. The only thing that changed was what their minds believed about what their bodies were doing, and their bodies listened. If our bodies listen that closely to a thought about exercise, think about what it does with the loss of the person that you love most in the world. And these experiments have been replicated where people just thought about exercising and actually improved some aspects of their physical bodies. This isn't a metaphor that I'm reaching for. It's about the most literal thing I'm going to say in this program today. Grief is not just an emotion. Grief comes along with emotions, but grief is a physiological event. It's a cascade of measurable changes in your heart, your blood, your immune system, and your brain. These are things that you could put on a chart. Grief can cause this in our bodies, physical changes that can be actually documented in laboratories. Bessel van der Kolk gave us the phrase for this. The title of his book says the whole thing in five words: the body keeps the score. The trauma that you don't process doesn't get filed away in some mental archive. It actually stays in the body, in the nervous system, waiting, keeping its own accounting. When Enna said the body holds what the mind can't, she was describing in the language of energy medicine the same territory that van der Kolk maps in the language of neuroscience. Two different vocabularies, two different ways of saying the same thing. One, what we would call scientific, the other one we might call woo-woo or metaphysical. But metaphysical only means going beyond the physical. It doesn't ignore the physical. So these are two different ways of saying the same thing, but it's one reality. Our bodies carry the load. So let me show you the score the body keeps. There are three places that we can actually measure it that I want to talk about today. We're going to talk about the heart, we're going to talk about the blood, and we're going to talk about the brain. Let's start with the heart. This one has a name that even cardiologists use. There's a condition, and it's been in the medical literature since 1990. The people who named it called it, quite seriously, broken heart syndrome. It sounds like poetry. It's not. It's a diagnosis. Its proper name is Takotsubo cardiomyopathy. Japanese doctors described it first. Takotsubo is the name of a pot Japanese fishermen use to trap octopus. It's got a narrow neck and a round base. They use that name because when this happens, the bottom of the heart's main pumping chamber balloons out into exactly the shape of that Takotsubo pot. So I want to say this plainly. Under enough emotional stress, the human heart can change shape. It can stop pumping properly. The person clutches their chest. They can't breathe. They go to a hospital, and every test says heart attack. The ECG, the symptoms, all of it. But the arteries are clear. It isn't a blockage. It's grief or terror or shock. Hitting the heart so hard, the muscle stuns itself. And here's the detail that really matters for our program. The single most common trigger doctors record is bereavement. The death of a spouse, the death of a child. In the reviews of these cases, the majority of patients had a major stressor right before it happened. And the emotional ones, the losses, sit right at the top of the list. This is not alternative medicine. The British Heart Foundation has a page on it. Your own GP knows the term. The mechanism, or the way this happens, is a flood of stress hormones, adrenaline and cortisol, surging through the body and overwhelming the heart. Your grief, it turns out, has a chemistry. And that chemistry can be strong enough to drop a healthy person to the floor. I actually have, unfortunately, personal experience with this. Last April, April of 2025, one of my best friends, Mike, passed away suddenly. He happens to live in my neighborhood, he and his wife, Lisa, and we could see their house from our kitchen window. We saw the ambulance there. We went over. Mike had a heart attack and ultimately ended up passing away. And as I was driving Lisa and her kids back to her house that night, she said to me, "My heart hurts." And I took this metaphorically. And I thought, well, of course your heart hurts. She not just lost her husband. And frankly, I kind of brushed it off thinking, well, you know, she's just speaking metaphorically. Took her home that night. A few hours later, one of her other neighbors had to take her back to the hospital. And she stayed there for several days and was told that she had had a heart attack. So again, that's just a little personal aspect of it that says I've seen this firsthand. This happens mostly to women past menopause. Now, it may be because typically it's the man who's passing away, but overwhelmingly this happens to women past menopause in up to 80 or 90% of cases. And this means if you're a woman in your 50s, your 60s, or your 70s, who's just lost the person you built your life around, your heart is not being dramatic, and don't let anybody tell you that. It's responding physically to an injury that medicine can now see on a scan. I want to say this very clearly, though. Most people recover. The heart usually reshapes itself in a matter of weeks. I'm not here to frighten anybody, but I tell you the rest so you stop dismissing what your body is doing. The chest pain is real. The breathlessness is real. If it happens, you go and you get seen. You don't tough it out. And it talks about the body speaking a language we've forgotten how to hear. Here is the heart speaking the most blunt sentence it knows. When you lose love, I feel it. Not as a metaphor, but as a muscle. We're going to go from the heart to the blood because the heart attack risk is only about takotsubo. Something quieter and more widespread is also going on. There was a large study that was published in 2014 in a serious cardiology journal. And it looked at people in the weeks after their partner passed. In the first 30 days, the risk of a heart attack or stroke roughly doubled. I want to repeat that. It doubled in the month after the loss. Doctors have a name for that, and it goes back decades. They call it the widowhood effect. Let's go back to a study from the 1960s. More than 4,000 widowers followed after their wives died. In the first 6 months, they died at a rate about 40% higher than men their age who hadn't lost a wife. 40%. Now, we talked earlier about the effect that losing a spouse could have on a woman. Now we're talking about widowers or men who had lost their wives. A 40% higher death rate in the first 6 months after they lost their wives. That's not just sentiment. That's not just emotion. That is a mortality table. Why does this happen? What is grief actually doing in there, in our bodies? When you lose someone, someone that you lived with, someone you built your life around, someone who's become literally part of your body chemistry, your body reads it as an emergency. The same ancient alarm system that fires when you're in danger switches on, and it doesn't switch off. The stress hormone, it's called cortisol, rises. And in bereaved people, it can stay raised for months. About the first 6 months, as a rule, of course that varies, but as a rule, about the first 6 months. When a death was sudden and unexpected, the kind that gives you no time to prepare, the cortisol runs even higher. Cortisol is there for a reason. It's there to prepare us for emergencies. But cortisol day after day does something specific. It actually suppresses your immune system. Again, this is measurable. Researchers have looked at the immune cells of people who've just been bereaved. In the first month or two, the cells that hunt down infection and damage, your natural killer cells, your lymphocytes, they get sluggish. They don't respond the way they should. And your defenses drop. This is why people get sick after a loss. They get chest infections that won't clear. Shingles, if you're an older person like I am, you get shingles flare-ups. The flu that knocks you flat when the flu never used to. This is not because you're weak. Your immune system has been turned down by the chemistry of grief. The body has pulled its resources, pumped them into cortisol to deal with the emergency that they can feel, but it can't fix.
UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Here's the part I want you most to hear. The part that turns all this science into hope. Instead of fear, that immune suppression doesn't last forever. For most people, by around 6 months, the numbers come back toward normal. The body recovers. Our bodies are amazing. The defenses come back up. But, and this is everything, there's a group for whom they don't. The people who have immune systems that stay suppressed are the people whose grief stays stuck. The ones that are still locked in, unresolved, unmoved, unexpressed grief, that goes on for many months on. So here's the thing. This is the thing that gives us hope. This is the thing that's really important to understand. The body recovers from all these things when the grief moves. The body stays injured, though, when the grief stays buried. Now, Enna said this exactly. Again, Enna Segal, who we spoke about last week, said this exactly from intuition and lived experience. Grief that isn't felt, processed, metabolized, whatever word you want to use, it gets stored. But when you finally let it move, something releases. And the blood work agrees with Enna. Your immune system is, in a sense, waiting for you to grieve so it can back down. Your cortisol levels will drop. All these things we've talked about so far go back to normal once you move that grief through you. And that's the whole argument of this episode in one sentence. So let's go back to the third place that we can measure it. And this might be the strangest one. Let's talk about the brain. Let's talk about the grieving brain. There's a neuroscientist named Mary Frances O'Connor. She runs a lab at the University of Arizona that's devoted entirely to this. 21 years of studying what grief does inside the brain. And she wrote a book called The Grieving Brain. Her core finding is this. When you love someone, your brain physically encodes that bond. It builds a map. Not a feeling, a map. Where they are. How to reach them. What your life looks like with them woven throughout every ordinary hour. O'Connor says the brain stops keeping a separate you and me and starts holding a we. Your wife, your husband, your child becomes part of the actual structure of your brain. Some of us who have been with our partners or our spouses for a very long time, we feel this. We may not know there's a scientific name for it or anyone's actually studied to validate our feelings, but we feel it. There becomes a time we don't think of yourself as an individual anymore. You think of yourself as we. You know where your spouse is. If I think right now of my wife, my brain goes immediately to the room above me and to my left where she's in her office working. When I would think about my daughter, Kayla, when she was living here, I would think about, you know, she's in her bedroom. Or even when she was in college, I could locate her in my mind when where she was on campus. So when we love somebody, when we have that connection with them, they become part of our brain chemistry. It's a bond. It's a map. So when they pass, when they're no longer here physically, here's what your brain is dealing with. It has a memory that says, they're gone. I was there. I know. So you've seen the body. You know that they passed. You attended the funeral. But it has a deeper, older wiring that says, they are mine. They are always available. They will always be here. They cannot be gone. And that question that we ask, where did they go? Where did they go? Because we can't accept that they're gone, right? We ask, where are they? Because you know they have to be somewhere. Both of these things at once, both are true to your brain, but they cannot both be true. They can't be here in that map that we had and also be gone. So our brains are just totally confused. This contradiction is unsolvable, and it leads to problems. O'Connor calls it the gone but also everlasting problem. Your brain holds two streams of information that flatly contradict each other, and it can't reconcile them. So what does it do? It keeps trying over and over. Is this true? Is this true? They can't both be true. This is what that searching is. This is the reason why you reach for the phone to call them before you remember. This is the reason why you set two cups on the counter. This is the reason you hear the front door at 6 o'clock, and for half a second, your whole body lifts, because that's when they always came home. This is the reason why you have that feeling, oh, they're just on a business trip. They're going to be back soon. This is not you losing your mind. This is your brain running a prediction that it built over 5, 10, 15, 20, 40 years, whatever the number is. And that prediction hasn't updated yet. Because your brain is a prediction machine. That's mostly what it does, all day, quietly. It forecasts what comes next based on what came before. This is what your brain does to keep you safe. This is what your brain does to make order of the world. You're always thinking, this comes now, this comes next. Death breaks that forecast. And your brain has to build its entire model of reality, one painful correction at a time. Every time you reach for that phone and you remember, that's a correction. That's the brain updating the map. Every time you get two cups out of the cabinet to pour two cups of coffee, your brain has to update that map. Every time you're at the grocery store and you're buying their favorite food, your brain has to update that map. And this tells us something that nobody wants to hear. Time does not heal grief. I wish it did. I wish we could just simply wait a certain period of time and our grief would be over. But time is only the room in which it happens. What heals is the work the brain does inside of that time, the relearning. Two people can sit in the same 6 months. One does the work, lets the feelings come, reaches for the phone, feels the correction, and let it hurt. Slowly the map redraws. The other spends those 6 months not letting any of it in. Same amount of time, completely different outcome, because it was never the clock doing the healing. When Shayna first passed away, I had said that I wasn't going to do the work. I was going to be miserable for the rest of my life. That was a vow that I made to myself because I thought that would make me maybe a martyr or show people how much I love Shayna if I was never the same again. But I went to a grief meeting a few weeks after Shayna passed, and I ran into a woman who had apparently taken the same vow, and she was miserable. She made everybody in the room miserable. And I realized I couldn't live that way. And I also realized at that point that processing the grief, by the time I would have probably said healing, I hesitate to say healing now because I don't think we heal grief, but processing that grief, it was a choice, and it was a choice she chose not to make. She had a completely different outcome, and I believe it was about 10 years after her daughter had passed when I saw her at this meeting. She was still going to grief meetings, by the way, 10 years after her daughter passed. I'm at 11 years now, and I can tell you, this is not to brag. This is because I was fortunate. I found the right resources, etc. I did the work, but we're in two different places. And O'Connor, in her research, found the two things to keep the brain stuck and stop the relearning. Avoidance is one, refusing to let the loss in, and rumination, looping the same thoughts without ever moving through them. Looping them without thinking about them, just mindlessly letting these thoughts run through our minds over and over again. That or avoidance, refusing to let the loss in. So these two things can keep us stuck. The two ways we try to manage grief by holding it still are the exact two ways we keep it from healing. That avoidance keeps it from healing and the rumination. And these are ways that we try to manage grief by holding it. So here's the hardest part of this whole subject. The thing that we most get wrong, the cost of staying strong. Somebody somewhere told you that strength means holding it together. That the brave thing is the dry eye, the steady voice at the funeral, being the one everyone else can lean on, getting back to work on Monday like a good soldier. What do? We look at those people and say, look how well they're managing their grief. Look how she's moving forward. Look how she's moving on. And we try to do this. We try to hold this. And that's a form of avoidance. I need to tell you that everything you've just heard tonight said that this is actually the most dangerous thing you can do. Let's look at what we've covered. The heart stuns itself under unexpressed stress. The immune system stays suppressed in the people whose grief stays stuck. The brain.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Is locked when we avoid the loss instead of letting it in. Every single system that we measure tonight gets worse, not better, when you suppress. So when you tell yourself that you're doing great, or you let other people say you're doing great and you're not processing your grief, when you're staying strong, you're actually keeping yourself from processing that grief and releasing these things that keep your body locked in the state of fight or flight. Staying strong the way we usually mean it is not strength. It is suppression wearing strength's clothes. And suppression has a bill. The body sends it later as the flare, as the collapse, as the illness that arrives like clockwork. I learned this the hard way after Shayna. There's a kind of man, and I was one of those, who decides he'll be the strong one, hold the family up, handle the arrangements, keep moving. And I did all that. And there's nothing wrong with that because, frankly, in the first weeks, months, you might have to do that. You've got to handle the arrangements. I had to do that. I had to keep moving. What I didn't understand then was the grief I wasn't letting out wasn't gone. It was going into my body. It was waiting. And I tell you, those feelings, those emotions that go along with grief, they are patient. They will be there. They will stay there. I can tell you from experience, they can last for decades. When my grandmother passed away, I didn't know how to express my grief. And it was, I wouldn't say decades, it was 4 or 5 years after my grandmother passed when I really processed my grief. that grief that I wasn't letting out in those early parts of my journey was waiting. Shayna is still my daughter, present tense. And the love I have for her had to go somewhere. That brain map that I had made for her, where she was, that I could think about, like she's in her room, or she's at volleyball practice, or she's in Florida at a volleyball tournament with her mother, like she was the week before. That brain map had to be reworked. I had to have somewhere to place Shayna. I wasn't ready to say she's gone. That didn't work for me, but I had to place her somewhere. So that grief held in, it would have made me ill. That grief let out became this, what I do now, this work, this conversation with you. So again, when I say grief is stored in the body and people say grief is stored in the body, you might think of that as a metaphor. You might think of it as poetry. But as we've talked about up to this point, it's neither a metaphor nor poetry. It can live in your heart, in your bloodstream, and yes, even in your brain. So now you know where it goes when you don't let it move. It doesn't leave. It just files itself in your tissue and it bides its time. When I'm working with clients, I actually, and I'm not saying this is some sort of a supernatural ability, but I visualize the grief as I talk about the anger and the guilt and the regret and the other things that come along with it. I visualize those things in their bodies and I want to help them move those things out. So what do? We talk about them. We process them. We admit them. We say them out loud. So that strength we talked about, there's a type of strength that we call keeping it together, but there's a very different kind of strength. That's the strength to let it move through you on purpose, to stop bracing. That's not weakness. That's the bravest thing a grieving person ever does. When I'm working with clients, very, very often, they break into tears. And it's really interesting because a lot of times they'll apologize to me. I'm sorry, I'm crying. This is not something I normally do. When I see a client crying in a session, I'm actually happy. I'm literally happy because to me that means they're processing that emotion. That means it's not stuck. That means it's moving through them. When they admit that they're angry at the person who passed on for abandoning them, or when they admit that they're angry at the doctor or the driver or whatever it happens to be, and when they express that anger, they might apologize to me, or they'll say, I'm off the subject now. I'm talking about, you know, this. No, you're not off the subject. They are processing that anger. That's the thing we need to do. We need to let it through. So moving it, what does it look like? It looks like you're in your kitchen on a Tuesday afternoon and you feel anger and you sit down and you journal about it, or you write a letter to your loved one or whoever the person is you're angry at, and you just let it all out on a piece of paper. And then you tear it up or you burn it, and you let that emotion through you. Or for me, I cried for I don't even know how long after Shayna passed, every single day. But a lot of times I'd be in the shower and I just let it out. Or the summer that Shayna passed, and I found an album by a group called Evanescence, and there's their first album but it's the one that happens to be titled with their name. And in that album, there's a lot of songs about being lost, about this world being a dream, and you know, all these emotions about unprocessed grief. And I just played that album over and over again. And every time I would listen to some of these songs, I would let these things out. I didn't know at the time I was actually practicing some sort of therapy, but I just knew it felt good to actually get down there and have those feelings and admit them. And it was so great because hearing another person, knowing that they wrote those words and felt the same way, made me felt less alone. And also gave me a way of processing it and letting it out. And I realized now that was the best thing I could have done. Now, it's interesting. I don't listen to the album that much anymore. It's been 11 years. I still listen to it occasionally as needed. It's kind of like a medicine for me, but it really did its work. So here's the principle underneath everything that I'm about to give you. Our mind processes grief by understanding. Our bodies process grief by discharge. Both have to happen. We are very good in our culture at trying to think our way through loss. And my clients a lot of times will say, okay, I know you've told me this. I have it in my mind. I understand this, but I'm still grieving. I still feel this. I still feel that. I'm still not where I want to be. That's fine because we're going to get it in our mind first before we get it in our bodies. We're very good in our culture, as I said, about trying to think our way through loss. We're terrible about letting the body do its part. So there are some ways we can let the body do its part. And I want you to understand, just because you're hearing this today doesn't mean your grief is going to be over. Just because a client works with me, we've been working together for a while, doesn't mean that the grief is going to be over. I wish I could just speak words to people. They would hear them and understand them, and the grief was gone. It takes a while to move through the body. These are metabolic type of processes. I use a lot of agricultural terms in my work, and I tell clients, you know, if you have a flower or a seed that you planted, and it takes 500 gallons of water for that seed to grow, you don't dump 500 gallons of water on it the first day and expect it to be a tree the next day. You have to slowly water it. That's the same way as we are is moving this grief through our bodies. Some of the ways to allow the body to do its work is movement. The body is built to discharge stress through motion. Now, when I talk about GEMS, which if you listen to me for any amount of time, you're always hearing me talk about GEMS. These are the four practices I have to help me with my grief and just basically mental toughness. Exercise is one of those. So for me, it's walking. Now, this is not small advice. For me, every morning, I walk 6 miles. And it's a great deal of my grieving has frankly happened during those walks. It takes me about an hour and a half to walk those miles. I walk with nobody watching. My body does what bodies do. I have rhythmic movement, left foot, right foot. Bilateral processing is really helpful. There's EMDR, which is rapid eye movement. There's binaural beats, which moves from both sides of our brain when it comes to music. Actually, walking is a bilateral thing, and it settles the nervous system in a way no amount of sitting and thinking can. So I'm not asking anybody here to walk 6 miles every morning. Most of us don't have the time, the patience, whatever. But if you can walk a few minutes after dinner or whenever it is that happens to work out for you, some sort of movement, some sort of moving your body can actually help your body to discharge stress. If you watch animals after a fright, they actually literally shake it off. Their bodies tremble and then they're done. It's really interesting. They'll after they go through a really stressful thing, they'll do a little shake. And it's like the energy, I imagine, just like being released back into the atmosphere. We are the only creatures who decide that shaking is undignified and learn to hold still instead. So when the wave comes and your hands tremble, let them. Don't lock it down. Cry hard if it comes. Crying is the body discharging. The tears of grief actually have a different chemical composition than any other type of tears, like say you're cutting onions or something. So let those things come through you. Breathe low and slow into your belly. By doing that, you're telling your nervous system the emergency can stand down. So the first thing to let your body do its work is movement. The second is expression. What stays trapped inside has to be given a form outside of you. So write it. Not for anyone to read. I remember I was working with the woman once and we get on a call and this woman was just so angry. It was just a half hour discovery call. For like 25 minutes, she was just telling me all the people she was angry at, particularly her ex-husband, just seething, white hot anger. I could feel it even through the Zoom screen. And so I told her to write it down and she said, well, do I send it to him? And I said, no, please do not send it to him. Okay. We're not here to damage relationships or make things worse, but write it out. And that way you can be very frank in your writing. Write it down, knowing that no one's going to read it. You can be as expressive as you want. It's something that nobody will ever see. There's good research that shows that putting the worst of it in the words on paper measurably calms the body's stress response. So again, don't feel like this is some just woo-woo thing or poetic or metaphorically speaking. Research shows this works. When it comes to anger, let's say, for example, write it out. Not for anyone to read, but just for your own edification. It might be, write it in a notebook that nobody will ever see, or write it on a piece of paper that you intend to tear up or to burn. And you can even see that as a way of releasing that back to Mother Earth or back out into the universe. This is actually something that has been shown to work. I remember after Shayna passed, I was so angry one day. I took an axe and I went out into the woods behind us and I just started chopping things down. So something that doesn't cause anyone or any property physical harm, but something to move that out. When it comes to other types of emotion, you can speak to your loved ones out loud in the car where it's only you. You can make something. You can paint, even if you paint badly. You can plant something. Put yourself into that. You can cook the meal that they loved. You can sing. Grief that can't find words will often find its way out through your hands or through your voice. Express it. And again, I can't tell you what's going to work necessarily for you, but find something that works for you. And when it comes to movement, which I talked about first, you know, I mentioned walking. It doesn't work for everybody. I know some woman that her mother passed away and she tried walking, didn't work. She tried yoga. People told her that. That didn't work. She found that she liked to power lift. Powerlifting happened to work for her. So whatever form of movement or expression works for you. The third way that we can move this grief through us is the one that we resist the most. Be witnessed. Tell one, thank you for spending this time with me on After the Storm. If today's conversation resonated with you, I'd love to continue the journey together. You can find more of my work at www.grieftogrowth.com. That's grief, G-R-I-E-F, the numeral 2, growth.com. Until next week, remember, after the storm is where the healing begins.